The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Carrie Rickey of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and it's my honor and privilege today to introduce and interview that embodiment of verve and elan, Leslie Caron, who's possibly France's most beloved gift to the United States since the Statue of Liberty. On the screen, she dazzled us as Lisa in An American in Paris, and Lily, and Gabby, and Gigi, and Fanny, among others, and that's just her first decade on screen. And apart from her incredible achievements as a dancer, award-winning actress, short story writer, and now hotelier, and memoirist, I might add, this intriguing woman may boast of being, by my count, the only woman to have danced with Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly, Mikhail Baryshnikov, and Rudolf Nureyev. So it is my pleasure to introduce Miss Leslie Caron. What a career.
Thank you. Hello, everyone.
Am I on here? Okay. So these are the ground rules. We'll begin with an interview with Ms. Caron, and I'll ask her some questions, which will give you some background and context for your questions. There'll be a half hour of questions from the audience, and I ask you, wait till you get the microphone before you speak. Okay, Ms. Caron. After the interview and questions from you, Ms. Caron will sign books. So that's in the lobby, correct? Excellent. And may I say, I highly recommend the book. It's full of beautiful writing, to the point anecdotes, and it's very compassionate, which is not like... unlike many memoirs, it's very compassionate. So, Ms. Caron, you grew up between the world wars.
And I wrote it myself.
Yes. There was no ghostwriter. And she wrote it in her second language.
Yeah. Difficult.
You grew up between the world wars and between two cultures. Your mother was an American dancer from Topeka, Kansas, and your father a Parisian pharmacist. How did American resourcefulness and French reserve work in the same household? Give us a taste of the cultural stew.
Well said, well said. Yes, my mother was forever practical in every way, and also she believed in liberty for children. She wasn't a mother to say, don't sit or don't stand on that chair, you might fall down. She encouraged me to climb trees. She wanted us to learn to swim before we could walk. She went for adventure and for freedom of the body. And she didn't care whether we were sloppy when we came back from the park. She wanted us to have exercised and be very skillful with our bodies, and this remained throughout my life. I remember when I was delivering my first baby, plotting how to get out of the bedroom in case of fire. What would I climb down? And I went and looked, was there something practical that I could climb down out of the building? So it remained with me, this feeling of physical freedom, and I think eventually it led me to ballet.
And your mother was a dancer as well, correct?
Yes, she had been a lovely, lovely dancer, very short career. She was in revues on Broadway, and she danced on Gershwin, as a matter of fact, and there's a beautiful picture of her in a sort of Degas tutu, which she had designed herself. and she had done the choreography, and I got into her book of clippings and found some old-fashioned glowing reports about her physical charm and grace and whatever. It was very old-fashioned, but obviously she was appreciated as being a very great potential. But in America, there were no ballet companies at that time. There was, there were, you could dance in opera a little bit, you know. And also there was those shows with sketches, and she would do her own choreography and so on, and costumes, and that was all until the Ballet Russe de Diaghilev came, or Pavlova. And Pavlova was the word in our household, so much so that I decided, when I started working, learning ballet, I decided I'm going to call myself Karonova.
You were 8 when World War II and the German occupation came to Paris. And your grandparents were forced to sell their private mansion and their getaway in the Pyrenees, which was very important to you.
Yes.
What do you remember about going from privilege to privation overnight?
I don't think it matters for a child. I didn't I didn't suffer. I'm sure my mother did, because she took to her bed, actually. She never got up again. But for us children, no. I don't think the lack of money affects children so badly. There were no clothes. We were, you know, you grew up, and sometimes you had to add a piece of green or whatever, or black or whatever, at the bottom of a skirt. And you had to sort of put a piece here to enlarge if you were growing, and a bit here. And that's the way you grew up, with clothes that were sort of, or it was your mother's clothes that was cut down a little bit. But the food was serious. The lack of food was a serious pain. I remember the very, very bare menu. We kept on having potatoes, but there were no vegetables, and there certainly was no butter. We had an egg full of butter per person per week. And for meat, you had one little slice of meat per week per person. I think children had one glass of milk per day. And, of course, there were no fruit. Fruit was very rare. And we started having animal fodder. We started having the vegetables they gave to cows, usually, and they're not bad. And then my mother went in between the railroad tracks and picked dandelions to make do for spinach, and that was very good. I recommend it. It's very healthy. She tried also seaweed, and that was a disaster. She'd been in Japanese restaurants where, you know, things are wrapped in seaweed, but the seaweed is treated. The one you pick on the beach is really inedible. It's rubber.
In your memoir, you write that you were motivated to study ballet as a way of gaining your mother's approval, but that when you announced your intentions to the rest of the family, it caused something of a stir. What was your grandfather's response?
Well, you have to understand that my grandfather was what is called a bourgeois. In those days, bourgeois were gentlemen of position and wealth, and there was a tradition at the opera house that they took seats, the first three rows, where they could see the legs of the dancers clearly. And afterwards, there was what is called a foyer, where mothers would present their daughters to these gentlemen, and a sort of agreement was reached, My daughter will have to have an apartment, yes, of course. Will have to have a carriage, yes, of course. All that is in Gigi. And in other words, being a ballet dancer was being a courtesan of a rather low echelon because she worked. And so when I announced I want to be a professional ballet dancer, my grandfather whispered, and I heard him, "Margaret, you want your daughter to be a whore." And it did remain with me. And the funny thing is that I was, at the same time, going to a very fancy convent school with the most glamorous nuns who were not even called sisters, they were called mothers. And they had purple outfits, and they were the regal nuns in Paris. So all the ladies of good society would go there, and there was this would-be whore.
So you were dealing with the sacred and the profane at the same time.
You were 16 when you joined Roland Petit's ballet company, and talk about how his company galvanized the cultural scene in post-war Paris and who you worked with, and especially Jean Babillet.
Babillet. I don't know if anyone remembers him. Babillet was the revelation after the war. He was short. He had all the qualities of Nijinsky. He could jump and stay there. And he just had so much grace and animal grace and beauty. Everything was just so beautiful. When he danced, it was you held your breath because there was also something so dangerous about his dancing. And so he was the star of our company. And immediately I was given a part where I was about 5 minutes alone on the stage of this incredible theater called Le Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, a rather new theater, very modern, very glamorous. And the Ballet des Champs-Élysées was the renaissance of Paris after the war. It was the first time the French had a ballet company, and the money came from a very rich donator, and we had something like 14 ballets, each with four sets, four changes of sets. So it was just so royal. It was run on a magnificent scale. The dancers were all very young and had a great deal of individuality, like during the Diaghilev company time, and all very young. And the ballets were very new, were made by Roland Petit with new music, new painters, new stories.
And didn't Cocteau do the designs for other... Jean Cocteau did the...
Jean Cocteau did designs, but mostly the argument, the story. Mm-hmm. And so it reflected far more the life. I remember some were a girl being murdered by the river, and there's a hunchback coming in, you know. Very much more realistic, modern, dramatic stories. And the one where Babillet was dancing with Nathalie Philippard, his wife, was about a young man in atelier under the roofs of Paris, under La Tour Eiffel, and he's dressed like a painter, and he's waiting for her. And the steps were absolutely so modern. He started the evening by looking at his watch. You know, you don't see that in Swan Lake. So anyway, he hangs himself at the end of the ballet, and that was terrifying. The whole effervescence was just a big thrill, and it was the fashionable place to go. and very successful.
And it was there while dancing with Babalay that Gene Kelly first saw you.
Yes.
And can you tell me why you weren't didn't meet him after that performance,
well,
when he was waiting
yes.
for you?
Yes, he came backstage. I was doing the Sphinx, and Babalay was Oedipus. And there's a tradition that everybody knows that you wait in your dressing room and the customers come and congratulate you. Well, I didn't know that. I was just 16, and I had no technique. So I'd gone home on foot with my flat shoes and, you know, my little white gloves, because I was well brought up. And I understand Jean Kelly asked for me and was told, well, she's gone home. So it's a year and a half later, when he was about to do An American in Paris, that he came to Paris with the intention of looking me up and making a test and hoping to convince the MGM that I would be hired to play his leading lady, which was an enormous... I mean, just imagine, he came to Paris. He wasn't even allowed to test me, but he tested me among girls who had already done a bit of filming, and he told me that he could be fired for this, but nevertheless. And so 2 weeks later, I got a phone call. You've been hired. You're leaving in 3 days.
So you're 17 when you leave?
No,
18. You're 18. Okay. So you're 18 when you leave war-scarred, famished Paris for overnourished and sunny Los Angeles. Your first impressions of Los Angeles.
Well, you know, in the little dressing room they have for me here is the one thing that was at that time so precious, a piece of Hershey. Hershey bar was like solid gold, a gold nugget. When the Americans landed in France, they distributed Hershey bars to little girls, little boys in the streets. But, you know, so in my mind, Hershey bars is something glorious. So there I arrive in Hollywood, and there were cars because they had petrol. You know, in France, there had been no petrol for 5 years, and even in 1950, there was still, we had coupons and for everything from food to dressing, shoes, and certainly for petrol. So there was really plenty of food, even to the point that it nauseated me. I remember the first dinner at La Rue's. We French say La Rue. And that was the fashionable place where all the stars went. And I ordered, like a good French girl, I ordered a piece of pâté and then a steak. You know, steak to me was a little thing like this. A T-bone steak came. That
was it bigger than you were?
Hang over the plate. Well, the waiter kindly said, "You want a doggy bag?" That's how I learned about doggy bags.
In the chapter when in her memoir where Ms. Curran describes what Los Angeles was like, understand that you were knitting your own underwear and you didn't have really a stipend to buy new clothes, so the studio gave you Elizabeth Taylor's hand-me-downs.
That was okay.
And
I did not feel underprivileged to me. You know, I mean, she had worn that costume in Father of the Bride twice, maybe 2 hours, and there it was, absolutely brand new, and I was thrilled to bits. Yes, it's true, my underwear was knitted by me, because you couldn't buy underwear. And the dress I came in, I had sewn myself, yes.
On a child's sewing machine, if I remember your memoir.
Yes, with a little wheel.
I say, tell us your favorite memory of An American in Paris.
Well, it was a great, great big machine, and in this enormous hall, very black and silent, except for the little group with this teal monster, the camera. And I found it all quite forbidding. And, of course, as this was Technicolor days, the painters thought it was very good to have glossy, glossy paint on the floors, on the cement floor, absolutely deadly for toe shoes. I mean, you can take a flying and end up on your tuchus.
A very proper French word. And you were dancing on concrete rather than wood, were
yes,
you not?
Yes, concrete, yeah.
So that must have been very hard on your joints.
It's hard on the, yes, it's hard on the legs. It's difficult dancing on concrete. And because wood gives when you jump, and it's soft, much softer. Anyway, it was an extraordinary experience. And the most difficult part of it was not the dancing, but the speaking. I had never spoken in public, and I had never acted, and I didn't speak English properly. So most of my lines I had to be taught phonetically, and Jean was forever trying to push me in front of the camera. We want your grandmother to see you in this.
After you completed An American in Paris, you threw yourself into a study of acting, serious acting.
Yes.
And with the same discipline that, to which you approached ballet. How are the physical and mental challenges of acting similar or dissimilar to dance?
Well, acting is based on instinct very much, and it's intellectual and it's nervous. You have to conduct your brain and manipulate your brain. You have to have another person in the back manipulating, and you have to manipulate your emotions and your timing and so on. It was absolutely the opposite to ballet. And after a while, I found it very difficult to do both. Also, I found that in ballet, you're meant to be splendid at all times. You're just meant to be the queen, the princess, and beautiful, beautiful pauses, beautiful movements. Whereas in acting, I was immediately put into parts of the poor little downtrodden girl who's surprised by life, surprised by, finds herself all alone and has to fend for herself. And the two personalities were in conflict. I found it very difficult. So I went.
It didn't show.
I went to Jean Renoir, the filmmaker, who was a very good friend and guide, and he lived in Beverly Hills, and I put it to him, I don't know what to do, I can't keep up. Also, ballet demands rigorous technique. It's like piano or violin. You just have to rehearse so many hours a day, or else you slip back, and I don't want to slip back. I'd rather stop. So he told me, well, I don't know if you're a good dancer because I know nothing about dancing, but I think you could be an actress. And so he wrote a play for me, and we came to Paris and did the play, and that was my introduction to real acting, and I thought from there on I'm going to end up doing Medea. But no, MGM wanted me to stay in musical comedies or, you know, light things. It became very difficult for me to get out of the sweet little gamine that they had discovered.
Now, let's have what we call in America a lightning round. I'm just going to say a name and you free associate. Gene Kelly.
Well, Gene was loved by one and all in the studio. He was a very simple guy. dressed in beige...
khaki pants.
Voila. And he wasn't always in very good training, so his Lacoste shirts hung out. Which means... In between films, there was sometimes a little bulge here. He wore what was called a beanie. I don't think that word is used anymore.
I think it is.
Is it? Anyway, it's a baseball
skull cap.
Baseball cap.
And was it that for a reason? Was he hiding something?
Yeah. Losing his hair. And he was hi, Genie, you know, Gino. Everybody would welcome him in the street. He walked everywhere. He was very simple with loafers. And he and his wife, Betsy, had a very simple house on, was it Rodeo? I think so, yes, 725 Rodeo Drive. And the door was open. You could just walk in, and Saturday night was the night when everybody was welcome. You just walked in, served yourself a drink, and did a turn at the piano or dancing or singing or whatever you wanted. And it was an open house every Saturday, absolutely wonderful, welcoming the Europeans or the people from New York who were there for a film or for a part, and he was very popular, so was Betsy, who sang completely out of tune. But it didn't disturb anyone.
Okay, Judy Garland.
Oh, Judy Garland was such a terrific girl. When I first came to the studio, they took me around to meet all the stars. And some were gracious, and some were, hi, and that's it. And some were rather nice, but Judy Garland grabbed me in her arms, gave me two big kisses, and said, "Welcome, honey, and good luck." She was very generous. She was,
and
just
it was
wonderful.
A very hard time in her life. She was just about to leave the studio.
Yes, she was going through very hard times, very hard times. And she was, as a matter of fact, things were so bad, it's very quickly after meeting her that she started on her one-woman show. And on the day she was to open in Long Beach, a whole bus was organized for all of us from MGM to go and hear her sing. And Long Beach is a sailor's town. So there was this long hall. All the parterre seats were taken by MGM and actors from other studios. And then up there were the sailors. Whistling, screaming, Judy! You know, absolutely incredible. Enthusiasm, and for the first time she sat on the edge and she sang Over the Rainbow with her mascara running, and she always finished in the clown, make them laugh, make them laugh, make them laugh, and then she would sing that in her clown's outfit, and those who haven't seen her do that haven't lived. It was just such a moment of warmth, and she had that great voice, my goodness. Unbelievable.
Talk about Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire as dancers, and what were their different strengths, and what was it like to be partnered by them?
Well, they were of different periods, of course. Fred only danced with girls. Fred was the best dancer Hollywood had ever had, and he did ballroom dancing, very sophisticated, as you know, with tap dancing and so on. But basically, he danced with girls, and basically, it was always very elegant, very dressed up, and that was the difference. Jean was athletic. Jean danced more or less everyday behavior with sailors, with footballers, with the athletics came much more into his interest as a dancer. Also, Jean had learned ballet and brought some ballet into it, like when he turns with one leg up, he often does that, an attitude. Fred never did that. But Fred had something very sweet. He said, listen, I could never learn ballet. Look at my hands. And it's true, he had enormous hands. And he said, well, I have to hide the enormity of my hands. So he sort of put one finger in front of the other and danced like this. Next time you look at a Fred Astaire, watch the hands, because he tried to make them look much smaller. It's very dear.
Tell us about stalking Stan Laurel. You have a chapter in your book about
Yes, during my childhood, Stan Laurel was my god. I just love their gentle humor and the stupidity of their sketches. And I thought he had to be brilliant because he could play stupid so well. I think I was right.
Didn't you take him roses?
Yes, with a bunch of friends. One of them was Jack Larson, the cub reporter in Superman, who was my very close friend, and a friend of his, Jim Bridges, the director. They had found out where he was finishing his life, on Pacific Palisades and in a modest little hotel. And so we went there with 4 dozen roses and wanted to meet him. But he told us over the telephone that he didn't want people to see him. He said, I don't want to disappoint my public. I don't want to be seen. So we sent up the flowers.
Very lovely tribute. Talk about your refusal to let MGM glamorize you when you played the orphan Lily. And do you think that you may have redefined the canon of beauty for the studio at the moment?
No.
No?
The canons of beauty stayed what they were, where they were. No, but they allowed me to finish the film as an orphan.
But didn't they try to put eyelashes and...
Yeah, page 36. I think at a certain point in the script, they got awfully tired of this. It looked like something the cat had brought home. And the word around the studio was, my God, look at her. A leading lady, she's playing that miserable little frump, flat shoes, dressed in gray with that horrible hat. This is not MGM. And so I was... told at makeup department that I had to glamorize and have curls, etc. And I was very upset and asked, but who's given these orders? And I went from the director to the producer, and finally the producer, annoyed with me, said, from above, darling. And I said, who's above? And he said, Mr. Doris Sherry. Oh, the big boss himself, God. So I said, I'm going to go and tell him that I really should keep this appearance. So I was given a car to drive to the front office, and I got from one floor to the other, and finally his private secretary said, Mr. Sherry will receive you. And the door opened, and God stood there with his arms open, and said, now, my darling, what can I do for you? And I said, oh, Mr. Sherry, I know it's page 36, and I know you think I'm not glamorous enough, but you see, she really is an orphan, and if we changed it, the film wouldn't be believable, blah, 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 blah. And he looked at me and said, what film are you making?
But you got your way. You got your wish. Which is important. Okay. Let's skip your first brief marriage to the Spam heir, Jordy Horimel, and tell us about your second husband, theater director Peter Hall, who directed you in the stage version of Gigi before you made the movie. What were the strains of a two-career marriage?
Well, at first it was, we were extremely happy, and that's, we had everything we wanted. We had two children who are by now magnificent adults and very successful with children of their own. And but very quickly it appeared that Peter expected me to give up my career. And to me it was impossible. I'd been trained since a child to perform and act and work, and I adored it, and I didn't know what to do with myself if I didn't continue this career. And so little by little it became really difficult. He didn't want me to go to Hollywood, and neither did he want me to act with his company, the Royal Shakespeare Company. So eventually that's what broke up.
Okay, let's do a quick lightning round, and we've only gotten you to through your first 10 years in Hollywood, I'm sorry, but they were very rich. Vincente Minnelli.
Minnelli called me Angel. Who can resist that? I was his. I just adored Vincent, and he was a very shy man. He couldn't finish a sentence. He was so nervous and inhibited, but he would carry with him an aura of quality and rhythm. And, you know, he was a painter to start with. He painted sets. And so we had a great contact. I loved working with him. And he liked pace at a period when all the films, if you look at them in the 50s, are very much slowed down because of this actor studio thing of think and suffer before you speak. You know, I mean, Vincent didn't go for all that. He just said, come on, let's get on with it. And rather, think faster, which is also good. So I loved working with him, and we both loved to... we were prop men at heart. We used to say that we were both colleagues prop men because he was very fussy about the book here and this color...
And the swans.
And the swan. Oh, the swans.
You can talk about the swans.
Okay.
Can I say, I've interviewed Mr. Minnelli several times, and he used to say that he was a Francophile and you were his favorite article of France. even more than Doofy.
Okay, I've got to tell the story of the swans.
Tell the story of the swans. It's great.
We were doing retakes of Gigi in the Jardin du Luxembourg. And we had this little pond in the back, and there were three miserable swans who were, you know, floating around. And he made me do that, I don't understand, the Parisians. About 15 times, and I kept thinking, what am I doing wrong? He kept saying, just one more, darling, one more, Angel. And one more, and one more, and one more. And I thought, what's wrong with me? And finally, he just exploded. Print! It's perfect! The swans were perfect!
On that note, we'd like to take some questions from the audience. Raise your hands and wait for the microphone. Okay. How about, well, while you're down here, how about this man in red right here?
In 1959, when I had the first experience of seeing you in a film in Gigi, I never dreamed that this experience would come to pass. So I'm just thrilled to be here, and I enjoyed hearing the questions that Carrie had to ask you. This is something that has concerned me because I was an acquaintance of the late Harold Rome, who wrote the score for Fanny, the movie that you appeared in. He was under the impression when he signed the contract to turn his Broadway musical into a film that it was going to be a full-sung musical.
Fanny. Yes.
And he found out after the contract was signed that it was going to be a movie with the background score that he had written as songs. What were you told at the time when you signed for Fanny?
I was told it was a romantic comedy. I was told it wasn't going to be a musical. I was never approached. I think they knew that my voice was not very well trained. No, from the start, it was going to be a romantic comedy.
Okay. Can I ask one more question?
Let's open. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's okay. Thank you.
This woman in the hat here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And yes, like the gentleman, you were one of my wishes come true. Question is, will you give us the privilege again of perhaps going back to Broadway One? And if you did, what would you like to do?
I would like to play a dramatic part. My dream for a long time was to be chosen to play Joan of Arc in George Bernard Shaw's Joan. I think it's a little late. But my wonderful Russian teacher taught me. We worked on Joan for, I would say, years, and I really understood the bluntness of her and her incredible conviction. That was all me. I was very much like that, and no compromise, you know, all that. Now I could play more mature women, like the women in Chekhov. That would be my dream. Playing one of the Chekhov ladies would be absolutely marvelous.
Excellent. We have a woman on the aisle, on the right aisle, in a red shirt and gray sweater, I believe.
Leslie, je m'appelle Colette.
Bonjour.
Bonjour. J'étais dans votre classe et je me demande si vous étiez à Fénelon. Est-ce que vous étiez à Fénelon, au lycée Fénelon?
This lady is asking me if I was in a lyceum in Paris,
yes,
called Fénelon.
Parce que nous sommes de la même date. Nous sommes.
I don't think I was in that one. I was in Les Oiseaux for a very short period.
Ah, très bien, très bien.
But we were in the same neighborhood.
That's right.
Excellent.
I was a rat, you know, and j'étais un petit rat. Et j'étais aussi avec Jean Babilet. Ma question est aussi, vous aviez un restaurant. You had a restaurant also outside of Paris.
Yes.
Remember La Chouette or something like that?
Lucarno Chouette.
La Lucarno Chouette, yes. C'est très joli. Est-ce que vous l'avez toujours?
Well, unfortunately, I'm a victim of the terrible crash, and the year was so bad, I had to close it. I'm looking for a chef to buy it. It should have a good chef. There isn't enough business to carry. I never was paid. I just did it and gave work to wonderful people, wonderful chef and his wife. But they made good salary. Only it's got to be taken over by somebody who can cook well and... It's a great opportunity. It's a beautiful place.
Okay. This woman in black on the left here. Thank you.
Ms. Caron, I'm just so happy to be here. My sister and my daughter and I traveled to France 4 years ago, and we spent the day traveling from Paris to your bed and breakfast. And we had a wonderful time, although you weren't there. You had been, Dominique, your manager,
yes,
had said we were a day late, that you had been there on Saturday, and we were there on Sunday. but she helped us get to the restaurant because there were no taxi cabs, which we didn't know after we got off the GAR. And we had a wonderful, wonderful time, and I'm just so delighted to finally see you today, and I can't wait to tell both my sister and my daughter.
Good, I shall tell her. I'm in touch with Dominique.
This woman in the black hat in the second row.
Bonjour, mesdames.
Bonjour.
C'est un plaisir de faire votre connaissance ici. Et je vais dire aux mes amis français que vous êtes à Philadelphie. I would like to know, what do you do to remain so elegant?
I wear old clothes from my old films.
And which film is this ensemble from?
Now, this one comes from, I'm not sure whether it's, I think it was a film which didn't succeed, which was called Let It Be Me. You can only see it on airplanes. But I do buy my clothes at the end of a film. It makes it easier. I don't have to go shopping. It fits me, and, you know.
Excellent fashion advice. A woman in, I think, a gray sweater, second in, back there. Yes, wave your hand. No, yes, yes. No, you, blonde. Yes, two hands, yes. Two-handed woman there. Very vigilant.
Just recently, I had an opportunity to see some of the musicals on a big screen, which I hadn't since I was a child. And I was shocked at how utterly remarkable, how indescribably lovely they were, films like Gigi and so on. Oh. Did you have any sense? We see these things on television now, and one can't possibly get the full impact. And did you have any sense when you were doing that work that you were creating, helping to create something that was so, so lovely and would always be a joy to watch for generations to come?
Thank you. Thank you. I think while we were doing Gigi, we knew we had a winner. Everything about the film was the best costumes, the best script, the best music, the best director, and remarkable actors, and MGM and Arthur Freed put so much at our disposal to make it good. So yes, we knew we were doing well, and there was, I think it's very much thanks to Arthur Freed, the great producer. He got together people who were from the same background and knew that period and loved the Colette story. There's also Colette in this. The story is remarkable. And Colette knew a lot of courtesans. She liked the company of courtesans. And there are stories in her memoirs about having dinner with famous courtesans and comparing their advantages and talking about men and what you do to keep them happy and so on. So she really was up on that subject. And, yes, during that film we felt very privileged. And also, I must say, I think it was the first American musical that was done on real location. And a great deal has to be said about that. We had the real Palais de Glace, the real Luxembourg Garden, the real Maxim's and Champs-Élysées and Place de la Concorde, and all that was there. We filmed in the month of August when most of Paris had gone to the country, and Paris was empty, and the police gave us free, not free, it was very expensive to buy, but they allowed us all those monuments and places so that we could have carriages and horses and costume people, and all that happened with a great deal of luck, except for the weather. It was just about the rainiest weather anyone could remember.
And you had just given birth, correct?
Well, yes, my baby was 3 months old. I was no little girl.
But I have to add that one of the great achievements of Gigi, which is one of my favorite movies, is that Vincente Minnelli, with his wonderful collaborators, was able to make a G-rated movie about the education of a courtesan. Go figure. There's a woman here in a gray sweater and vest, right here in the middle. Wait for the microphone. Wait for the microphone.
It's such a privilege, and I've been such a fan for so long. I just like to comment on the L-shaped room
Do sit excellent. Down because they can't see behind.
Your work as a dramatic actress, and especially recently, I loved you in Law & Order Special Victims Unit. I thought you were wonderful.
Which earned Ms. Perrone an Emmy.
Yes. So congratulations. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
I'm really going to tell that to my producer, Neil Baer. After that, you know, Neil Baer, who started ER, he is a doctor from formation, and he went into television, created ER, moved on, and took over Law & Order Special Victims Unit. And he's the one who designed that part for me. And when I got the Emmy, he said, good, now next I want your star to be on Hollywood Boulevard. And I'm going from here to Los Angeles, and on the 8th, I'm going to unveil my star next to Gene Kelly.
Let's see, we haven't...
I'm not sure I answered her question. Oh. What was your question?
Thank you.
Difficult to watch, yes. Yesterday I met a woman who had been raped, and she had gray hair, and you could see she absolutely gave up being a woman after that. And she said, I'm out of it. She was about 60 by then. I'm out of it, but it's ruined my life. So I'm glad I was. I asked her, did you feel I portrayed you properly? And she said yes.
Excellent. On the aisle, a man with raising up his black sleeve. Thank you.
Of course, on this side.
Can you wait for the microphone? Thanks.
Okay. Of course, on this side of the Atlantic in the 50s, we had a right wing witch hunt. And also in Europe, I know that there was controversy about Arletty and Marcel Carnet and Jacques Prévert about the making of Children of Paradise. And I know Chevalier is shrouded in, you know, people contemplating that he was a Vichy sympathizer. So were there any parts either in Gigi or other things that he did where people might have balked at working with him?
Well, I don't think those people you're talking about, except for Arletty, who did have a German lover, I don't think that... Am I right? Wait a minute. I'm thinking of Coco Chanel. Coco Chanel went off to Switzerland with a German officer. And it is the Duke of Westminster who talked to Churchill and said, I want that woman to be left alone. But Arletty was bothered a bit. She had a bit of trouble. And I'll tell you what it's all about. It's not that they were sympathizers. It's just that all the artists who kept on working under the German occupation and were sometimes given privileges of coal, food, clothes, were jealous. Is that a word?
Jealous?
Were
envied.
And a lot of bitterness. There was a lot of bitterness against them for having lived pretty well during the occupation. And that was the case with Chevalier. He kept on, I think, performing and received some special privileges. It doesn't go any further than that. And as far as I know, I think he was asked to make a generous donation to, I guess, the victims of the war, and all would be forgiven. And this is what happened. And by the end of it, by the time we did Gigi and by the time we did Fanny, there was no more bitterness against him.
Thank you. Thank you. This gentleman right here in the second row. And we only have two more questions, so this is the second to the last.
Yes, I'm so impressed with your energy and your gracefulness. And does your ballet training in the earlier years, do you still do ballet warm-ups or exercises and breathing at all? Because you have such flexibility even up there. I was just curious.
Oh, thank you. No, I don't practice anymore. I gave up when I started rebuilding the auberge, which is about a good 10 years ago. And no, I've had a hip replacement, like most dancers, I'm afraid. But I walk my dog.
What kind of dog?
I have a Shih Tzu. And he's adorable, and he wouldn't give up his morning walk for anything in the world. So 7:38 for an hour, I go walking with him, and I try to walk a lot, but I don't do any more than that.
I think that's the secret of all Parisians' beauty, is Parisians walk everywhere, they all have beautiful legs, and they're all very fit. One last question. This gentleman here has been very patient.
Thank you. Thank you for coming to see us.
Thank you.
Did you work under Louis B. Mayer, and do you have any stories you can share with us about him?
Oh, that one is too long. You must buy the book.
Thank you all for coming, and Ms. Caron will meet you soon in the lobby.
Many thanks.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.